on the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, all of that. I hope you're having a great week with your family and friends. And while you drive around, put on a show and listen and learn and don't yell at the other people around you. They're listening to bad stuff. So anyway, I hope you're having a great holiday week. We've got a great show for you today to listen to as you drive around. We have Philip Cantrell. I will introduce him in just a second, but promise you he is damn impressive, and you will really enjoy the interview. After that, we have a greatest hits with Justin Sachs, who you may not have heard of, but is one of the publishing superstars in the United States. We had to get those back up from a dead server, so it is a greatest hits as well. We're going to get started right now. Here we go. We've got a great guest to introduce you to first, though. We got to make some money here before we go on holiday, right? Please welcome Philip Cantrell to the show. Very successful career. Boy, listen to this. Founder and CEO of Benchmark Realty, which he grew to one of the top, let's say 100 or so, in the industry of 20,000. So an amazing success. He has some 25,000 agents and $35 billion in revenue underneath him at United, which is a real estate, a residential brokerage that he also is involved with. And he has a new book out that is incredibly successful. It actually has more reviews than mine, which is very rare, I must say. The book is called Failing My Way to Success, Lessons from 42 Years of Winning and Losing in Business, and has 169 five-star reviews. That is amazingly impressive. Philip, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you, Jim. I'm glad to be here. I'm doing great. You know, it's kind of chilly in Tennessee right now, but other than that, I'm okay.
It's chilly here in Atlanta as well. Are you in the Nashville area?
I am. I actually live in Franklin, Tennessee, which is about 20 minutes south of Nashville.
Yes, I am well familiar with it. Lots of entrepreneurs there, and a lot of media people live in Franklin, too.
Yes, a lot of country music stars. That's not uncommon to run into them at Starbucks, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of funny.
Yeah. I ran into Whitney Houston and what was her husband's name?
Oh, you're that guy. Asking me.
Anyway,
yeah, that guy.
At a Starbucks one time.
Yeah, well, interesting story. I was in Starbucks a few months ago, and I didn't pay much attention. I was going in the back door, and a fellow paused and opened the door, let me go through. I looked up. It was Keith Urban.
Wow. Yeah.
it's not uncommon to find that in this area for sure, which is kind of interesting. I'm actually a native Nashvilleian, so having grown up around country music all my life, I'm really not that enamored with it, but it's good, and it brings great economic benefits to our economy here locally, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. It's great for the economy. So,
yeah.
All right. Yep. Let's talk about your book to start. Tell us about it. Failing My Way to Success.
So, interesting story. I mean, anytime somebody has lived a long time, they've accumulated a tremendous amount of experiences. Not all of them positive, not all of them good. So what I tried to do in this book was accumulate those and share them with future entrepreneurs. That is the avatar for the book, basically, is the fledgling entrepreneur that is attempting to get started and doesn't really know what he or she doesn't know. They don't know what they don't know yet. And generally, they find them out by stepping on a landmine and figuratively blowing a leg off. And so what I've tried to do in this book is share my experiences so hopefully they can avoid some of that pain.
All right. And, excellent. Let's go through some of the lessons.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, just kind of give you a little more background, if I may. I have in my career founded 10 separate companies in two separate industries. The first one was commercial printing, The second is real estate brokerage. And in those businesses, many, some have been successes, some have not been successes. If you put it in sporting team terms, my record would be 4-4-2, 4 wins, 4 losses, and 2 ties. So you learn a lot in that. And some of those lessons I learned is that you have to develop a set of systems. So I kind of broke it down in the book in analysis. And I'm a big note taker. I take notes wherever I go. I have a little black binder I carry with me, and I'm constantly jotting ideas and things that I discover in that book. And so in analyzing all of that, I realized that I can break it down into 4 basic pillars of leadership success, if you will. And they're named observation, delegation, working smart, and compassion. And that kind of summarizes the whole concept of the book, really. So observation is, number one, looking outside your industry and seeing what's going on in other industries that are best practices that can be applied within your industry. In many cases, we get in this rote learning mode in an industry and think, well, this is the only way to do it. And the words, because we've always done it that way, are the worst 7 words ever invented in the English language. So observing and then installing those. Delegation is learning that you cannot do it all yourself. You must delegate certain critical tasks to other people. And this is a failing of mine, a tremendous failing of mine throughout the years, is that I felt like nobody can do it better than me, and I can do it faster than I can explain it to somebody else. Does that sound familiar to anybody out there listening?
Oh, it's so true. I still do that. Yeah. I mean, when it's true that it takes longer to explain it than just do it, don't you just still do it?
The first time, that's absolutely true. The second time, it's not. The third time, it gets easier. The fourth time, you don't even have to talk about it anymore. So it's making that little investment up front to yield big benefits later on. And that's the secret of the delegation, of understanding that when you do delegate, when you do assign someone a task and hold them accountable for performance of that task, then you should be done with it. If you're not, then you've got the wrong person, and you've got the wrong people in the wrong seats on the bus. Working smart is another one. I mentioned earlier that I'm a note taker. I constantly have binders that I carry with me, and I'm always writing down important things. And that's when you see something, a function stream within your business that you consistently perform over and over again, to develop a system, a standardized system to accomplish those tasks. And that's called working smart. It's not, if you don't do that, you are effectively reinventing the wheel every time you perform that task or that function. You can take any business and break it down into micro sections. And when you break it down into micro sections and then you document those micro sections, then you have a standard policy procedure for each process that you perform in that business. And then you achieve what Jim Collins talks about, the flywheel effect. It takes really hard to get it going the first time, but then after a while, it takes minimal effort to keep that flywheel going. And the secret to that flywheel, in my opinion, is working smart and documenting the processes that you're doing. The fourth pillar of leadership for me is compassion, is understanding that you are working with humans. You are not working. There may be machines involved in your business, but the humans are the ones that make the creativity of those machines function correctly. And so understanding that and realizing that people have lives outside your business and try to make it better for them in a place that they want to go to work instead of a place that they have to go to work. And that's an important differential. The big thing for me has always been understanding that you in business, if you focus solely on the money, you've already lost. That's like trying to play football, staring at the scoreboard. You have to focus on the game. You have to focus on helping others get what they want. And then the money is the scoreboard of your service to others. And that's what the compassion means. So those are important 4 pillars: observation, delegation, working smart, and compassion.
I love it. Great. Absolutely great. Philip, tell us about a failure.
Golly, you know, the important thing is the end to understand everyone is going to fail at some point or other. That's a guarantee. At some point, you will fail, but you can never let failure or setbacks derail you. in many cases, got into the mortgage business once or twice and realized that I had the wrong partners. My book talks extensively about the importance of measuring your partnerships correctly. I have proven to myself that I don't do partners well. And that happened many times, or a couple of times in my career, where I just had the absolute faith and trust in a partner and I let go of it too quickly. And that happened more than once, actually, you know. So understanding this is, you kind of go back to Stephen Covey, right? Between talking about failure and how you deal with failure and how you recover from failure. And he talks in the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. He talks about the space between stimulus and response, right? Every time you have a stimulus, you have a failure, you have an urgent situation, whatever happens, there's a space between that and your response to that situation. And in that spot, that space is the power of our control of our response. And what we fall into is a rote pattern, almost a muscle memory pattern of responding to certain stimuli a specific way. And we don't even realize we're doing it, because over a period of time, we just developed an automatic type of response to a certain type of stimulus, whatever that is. But in that space, to stop and pause and consciously choose your response is where your power lies and where your ability to drive through that failure lies. And I've discovered that in my career, that it's important to take measure and to document. Again, we go back to making the notes, right? To take measure of what that response is, what your last response was, and what your new response should be, and how your outcomes can be totally different if you capitalize on that space between stimulus and response, between the event happening and how you react to it. That's where your power lies. That's where your success lies.
And how do you slow down before you give out a stupid response?
Well, in many cases, you have to do something to change your physical state. In my case, I realized that, you know, you have an urgent situation that comes up and you get in this, you know, your blood pressure goes up, you break out into a sweat, you engage in feverish activity without really even thinking, believing that you're a fireman putting out a fire. But if you stop and you actually do something physical, in my case, I will stop and clap my hands, literally clap my hands. And that physical action breaks the physical response, the rote memory muscle response to the stimulus. And it's an interesting effect how that works, because we don't realize we're doing it, right? I mean, it's just one of those things that happens automatically. We go into the mode. But the key then is not to immediately know what you're going to do. The key is to immediately stop the physical response that's automated within your DNA. And that works very effectively for me.
That would be weird to see you just start clapping in the middle of a conversation.
Well, to be clear, I don't have multiple claps. It's just like one clap, or maybe I'll pat myself on the side of the head or smack my jaw sometimes, you know. But yeah, it is kind of interesting. And then I have had people observe that and say, "What are you doing?" And I say, "Well, I just changed the whole conversation, didn't I? Just in that one physical act, I changed the entire conversation, and now the emergency is not so much of an emergency." And that's the thing, you know, we get in these scenarios where we just handle things the same way every time, and we don't even realize we're doing it. But we just need to stop and think for a second, how can this outcome be different? And it's really powerful once you get a handle on that.
That is very impressive. And you do that on the way home as you're driving home, go over these situations in your head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I am a big, what's the proper word for it? A big, analyzer. Forensic accounting is a good example. In other words, studying something after the fact. So I do a lot of forensic thinking on my way home. Fortunately, I don't live far from the office, and many days I actually work at home now. But going through the processes of the day, not to dwell upon the negativity, but to say, okay, this happened. I recognize that this happened. Now, when that happens again, how can I do that better? And then the key point in leadership here, though, is you can't keep that to yourself. You have to go share that with your team. and you have to engage in a forensic discussion to analyze the process and what happened. So many people in business, the first thing they want to do is place blame. And the blame, this is a newsflash for everybody, the blame here rests with the guy or gal at the top, period. It happened on your watch. It's your responsibility to fix it, to change your system, to change your processes so that it doesn't happen again. And you cannot do that without looking at it in a fair and unbiased manner and trying to figure out a better way to do it. Better, faster, cheaper, better, faster, cheaper, better, faster, cheaper. All of it designed around the concept of helping others get what they want. And if you help enough other people get what they want, you will never have to worry about your own success. It will be guaranteed.
I love it. That is a great line. We'll tweet that one out.
Well, it's stuff that I've learned most of the time because I've been bludgeoned. and all of that leads into personal growth, right? So as a leader, you're not going to be effective. As a business person, as an entrepreneur, you're never going to be effective unless you are constantly striving to become better yourself. I'm an avid reader. I will read 50 books a year, most of them on Audible because I do a lot of exercising. I'm a big walker. I do a lot of walk, 3 to 4 miles a day if I can. Learning, always learning something. And so that is, I believe the brain is a muscle. And it's like any muscle. If you don't exercise it, then it will atrophy. And so I exercise my brain through trying to learn more stuff. And then that has translated to a theme that I have tried to communicate to all of my people also. And being in the real estate brokerage business, I am working with lots of independent contractors and trying to help them understand the key importance of doing just one more thing every day than you did yesterday. And here's a math thing for you. I'll back that up with real math. So, one to the 365th power is what? It's still one, right? So we're going to do math here. Are you with me, Jim?
Yeah, I was really glad that you answered that question yourself and didn't make me answer it because I thought it was one, but I wasn't 100% sure.
I understand. It's one. So if you don't improve some way, somehow each day, then you're going to be exactly where you are today, 1 year from today. And that's what most people end up being. If they're not improving. So let's do some more. Let's take that math problem one step further. So 1% more effective. So 1.01 to the 365th power is 37.8%. So by simply making a 1% improvement in your daily tasks in a year, you will be nearly 40% more effective than you were today. 40%. All right, it gets even more stupid and beyond that. A 2% improvement, 1.02 to the 365th power, right? 365 days in a year, so that's where that 365 comes in. 2% improvement equals a 1,377.4% improvement in your productivity and activity. A 1,400% improvement in 12 months simply by a 2% improvement on a daily basis. So that's the key to success. Break it down into bite-sized increments. Goes back to how to eat an elephant, one bite at a time. That's how you do it. So if you do a 2% improvement, you will be 1,400% better in a year than you are today. Is that not something everyone would like to see? But you have to have dedication. You have to stay after it. You cannot stop. You cannot let up. You cannot stop for a moment. If you back off and go back to 1 to the 365th, in other words, you have zero improvement for one day, you just shaved off a percentage, 2 or 3 percentage points of that. But anyway, you get the point. And it's incremental improvement is where success lies in any business, in any career. And that requires staying focused in what you're doing and being aware of destination addiction, right? So work in the incremental baby steps as opposed to working in the, I want to get to that place down there. You have to have goals, 100%. You have to have goals, but you cannot focus on the goal to the extent that you are ignoring your daily tasks and daily activities that are required to achieve that goal. That's a very important lesson that took me a very long time to learn. I hope that makes sense.
It does. It does. And yeah. I loved your description of continual improvement. The Japanese term is Kanzan, and you described it almost word for word the way a Japanese would.
Well, I'm an old Southern boy, but, you know, it just makes common sense to me, and these are things that I have learned over time. I have studied Deming. Deming philosophy brought a lot of that to the Japanese.
Yep.
I have most of a master's degree in economics, so I've studied quite a bit of that, just in time delivery and all that. In fact, my first half of my career, 19 years in commercial printing, I ran a manufacturing plant. So my brain is a manufacturing trained brain, not a sales trained brain, if that makes sense.
It does.
And that's where a lot of this stuff comes from. I mean, I got in this industry and I said, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but the way you guys are doing business makes no sense to me at all. So I've started a company and said, I'm going to do it different. And Benchmark Realty is actually the company that I sold to United Real Estate. In fact, the stats that you quoted were United Real Estate's stats, but Benchmark itself is $5 billion in sales this year and about 2,000 affiliated real estate brokers and agents. And we've done really well. I sold it to United Real Estate 5 years ago. I've been hanging around helping grow the company, helping secure and stabilize the company for the last 5 years. And then effective January 1, I'm going to switch from a W-2 employee to a 1099 consultant. Still on retainer with Benchmark, but not nearly at the money I was making as the CEO. So it's time. And that's an important lesson in that too, is that when you find yourself in that transition, if you get to a merger acquisition condition where you do sell your company, the worst thing you can do is hang around too long. You know, you don't want to let go too fast, but you also don't want to inhibit the growth of others that are coming behind you. And so that's my intent, and that is the plan that I've been working for 5 years, and now it's time to put that into play. We've got a lot of good people here that are going to continue to grow this company, and that's how you build solid society-changing companies, is by making sure that your legacy and those that come behind you are prepared for what they're asked to do. Works really well.
You're the easiest person in the world to interview, Philip. You just keep going like the bunny.
Well, sorry about that.
Excellent. What do you see in real estate residential market right now?
Markets? We did our budgets for 2026. We're anticipating a 13% improvement. Our market in this area, of course, the thing to understand is that all of real estate is local. So I could give you a lesson on real estate economics that would not apply in Atlanta or not apply in California. It's just different worlds and different areas, and I get that. Overall, I think we have, generally speaking, a stability in the market. We are specifically budgeting a 13% increase, but we are in an anomaly in our business because we don't hire newbies here. We only hire experienced real estate agents, so we usually and typically do blessed by the fact that we do better than the local market. Our local market is actually down about 3 to 4% right now. But I think we're going to loaf along here. I don't see tremendous rate drops in mortgages, and I'm not real sure that it matters. The problem we have is that we had a huge, tremendous run-up in prices because the government was just pumping cheap money in the economy. And anytime you pump free money out there and cheap money out there, then you have a lot of it, and that drives prices of assets up. And that's exactly what happened with home prices in America, particularly in our area. Between 2015 and 2022, we had a 100% price increase in the median home price in greater Nashville area. 100% increase in 8 years is not sustainable in anybody's book. It's not real, and it's strictly driven by cheap money. So when that happens, it takes a while for the markets to reach equilibrium, and they can only reach equilibrium by settling out and calming down. And so we're settling out and going through that calming down period right now. The U.S., we will close about 4 million homes in the United States total, in the whole United States. That's down from 6.5 in the go-go years of 2021, where we had a lot of pent-up demand, and they were just pumping money into the economy like crazy. So it's kind of one of those things where we have to just take a breath. Just take a breath. I know there's a lot of noise in the media right now about the Federal Reserve and what they're doing and what they're doing. They're going to drop the rates again here in shortly, but you will not see the mortgage rates drop because the investors, the mortgage-backed securities already have those, anticipate that they already built into the price. So you're not going to see much movement. So they will calm down and settle out and be around 6.1, 6.2, 6.3 for the next 12 months, maybe the next 15 months. Beyond that, it's hard to visualize, to be honest with you. And so it's a matter of right now in our market, well, nationally, there are 37.8% more buyers in the market than there are sellers right now. I'm sorry, other way around. I said that wrong. More sellers than there are buyers. So it's a buyer's market. But it's a buyer's market, but a lot of people don't want to move because of the money. So that's a rough. I could go deep on that if you want to, but you
we're out of time. I'm afraid we need to pay attention to the clock.
Yeah, it's the master. It's the master for everything. Yeah.
Philip, great information, and I can see why you are so incredibly successful. How do we find out more? Get a copy of the book. Come have dinner with you. All that stuff, please.
Well, all that good stuff. My website is probably the best way to catch me. It's philipcantrell.com. It's Philip with two L's. Last name is CANTRELL.com. You can order the book from there. I'm on Amazon in all four formats, hard copy, soft copy, hardcover, soft cover, Audible and Kindle. It's all on Amazon. And just remember, there's two L's in Philip. And my email address and contact info is there on the website, philip@philipcantrell.com. Pretty straightforward stuff.
Fantastic. Philip, thank you so very, very much for being with us. Happy holidays, and we'd love to have you back next year. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Jim. Appreciate you.
And we will be right back.
Well, that's a wonderful question, actually, Jim.
Oh my gosh, I love the opportunity to do this. Thank you, Jim.
Wow, that's a great one.
You know, that is a phenomenal question.
That's a great question, and I don't have a great answer.
That's a great question.
Oh, that is such a loaded question, and that's actually a really good question.
School for Startups Radio.
And welcome back to School for Startups Radio again. Thank you so much for being with us today. I am very excited and honored to introduce you to our guest today. His name is Justin Sachs. He was on the show about 3 years ago, and his background is just amazing. He started off working with people like Tony Robbins and some other people like Mark Victor Hansen, who's absolutely one of my favorites. I love his columns. And at the age of 18, he published his first book. He now has, I think, 6 books out. He's produced 3 movies. He has 5 international bestsellers. He's been featured in MSNBC, CNBC, Fox, Yahoo, all of these sort of places. He is also the owner of Motivational Press, which is one of the top publishing companies out there, and has gotten books published for hundreds of other people. And if you go on the Amazon site for him, he has quotes from people like Arnold Schwarzenegger, President Bush, people like that who are talking about his amazing accomplishments and what he has been able to do at such a young age. He is also very dedicated to giving back to the community. He's won lots of awards and accolades, including the Prudential Spirit of Community Award for his efforts there. Justin, welcome back to the show. Congratulations on getting married. How are you doing today?
Thank you. I'm doing great. Thanks. I'm excited to be with you, and I'm certainly looking forward to sharing a bit with you and chatting further.
Well, I'm just excited that you're getting married. It is the world's greatest and the world's worst thing that can happen to a man. So congratulations.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Talk to us about getting your very first job. I think your first job was working for Tony Robbins, your first real job. Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, I did a little stuff, you know, helping the parents around with their work and everything. But the real, you know, my real first job where I got to kind of create my own employment, if you will, was at Tony Robbins. And it was in 2004. It was at a time when, you know, for him, his business was growing really steadily. You know, things were really exciting for him at that time. And I got to see really a lot of transformation occur in the personal development industry as the recession hit and going through that turmoil, you know, where he really took a leading role in guiding and transforming people through those challenges. And then coming out of that on the other side, the industry changed because you really had to focus on online marketing more than ever before. You know, his up until then, he was doing a lot of grassroots, on-the-ground marketing where he would go into corporations and speak, and he'd have his team do the same and those types of things. But it stopped working the same way that it used to, which really required a unique new taste of marketing, a new strategy around how to get things done. And so what we like to focus on, I mean, we in our organization look at that all the time of, you know, in times of change, which, in the, you know, I run a book publishing company, we are always in times of change. There's whether we're in ebooks or print books has just changed back again. You know, things are constantly changing in this business. And so for me, it was the perfect lesson way back then to see how quickly you can adapt, change, and grow with the changing economy and with the changing infrastructure that a lot of industries find.
How did you get the job, though? I mean, I bet he had 1,000 applicants for the one position.
Yeah, you know, I say it's kind of a lesson for me and for those that I work with. Is for me, it was give first. I volunteered for his nonprofit organization and was well connected within his organization before I ever got hired. You know, and so, you know, it was a great lesson for me on giving before you expect to receive. And it, you know, is something that I think really I've carried with me in my organization for quite a while, is that how important it is to be focused on giving first, and then everything else seems to just follow organically.
And weren't you like 17 or something at the time?
At the time, I was only 14 at the time. I worked for him for 5 or 6 years till I was 19, and then I started with Mark Victor Hansen following that.
Wow, unbelievable. And you were going to school at the same time and all of that?
I was, yeah. I was in high school at the time, so I worked in his office, you know, after school, after high school. And then on the weekends, I was at his events, helping him sell, helping him, you know, train, work in different environments. So it was a great opportunity for me to learn on two sides, right? The traditional education that so many of us, you know, get to experience. And then on the other side, something that was nowhere near the same, right? I mean, for anyone who's been to a Tony Robbins event knows that he believes in giving you as much as you possibly can as far as education goes, as far as value goes, and doing it as quickly as he possibly can. So for us, it was mind-boggling to see how quickly you could learn something in one environment and how long it took to teach in the other environment.
And why in the world did you think at the age of 18 you could publish your own book? I mean, talk to us about the mindset behind that decision. Most 18-year-olds are just trying to get some illegal liquor, and here you are thinking that you can publish a book. Why are you so special, Justin, that you can do this? What's the mindset behind someone who makes that decision?
You know, it's a great question. I was 80% through the book before someone ever said, "Who are you to write the book?" You know, so I was very lucky in that I had already decided to write the book. I'd already written most of it before anyone ever told me I couldn't do it. And when they told me I couldn't do it, the question wasn't so much to say you can't write a book. It was to say you better figure out your uniqueness in the marketplace. You better figure out, you know, what makes you so special that you think you can tell people what you're trying to tell them. And the question was something I struggled with for a while, as I think most of us do when they try to define what makes them in any business or even personally in their lives. And so going through that process really allowed me to, I think, in a large respect, open up to the possibilities that, you know, that came along with really being actively focused on growth in my own life and what opportunities that meant and made available to others.
Was that Your Mailbox is Full? Is that the first book you did?
That's right. Yeah. Real Teens in the Real World, Your Mailbox is Full. It was one of my favorite books, actually. It's really an incredible read.
Why is that one your favorite? You've done so many other things. Why is that one still have a special place in your heart?
You know, that one, the funny thing is it almost expresses my innocence in the market, right? Because for me, I was brand new to business. I was brand new to the world of authorship. But what I had was a large amount of experience, 7-8 years of experience by that point, in personal development and self-help. And I was lucky enough to have one of the most extraordinary mentors in the world guide me through a lot of that over the course of those first, 5 years. And so for me, it was about as raw as you could get in terms of real hardcore content from personal development, specifically focused for teens. Like there is, I don't think there's a better book in the marketplace for teenagers looking to find what's going to work for them and what's going to create their success. There just isn't anything better out there.
Should I give it to my 18-year-old son, 16-year-old daughter? Is it still relevant to them, you think?
Absolutely, yeah. Anywhere between, I mean, I've had adults read it and love it, but ultimately it's for kids between the ages of 12 and 22.
Okay, and what would the lesson be that they would take away? What's the thesis?
Well, it's written in a way that every day you can read one page and take something different. So whether one day it's goal setting, another day it's time management, another day it's avoid drugs and alcohol, another day it's, you name it. There's so many different lessons that you take. And every day, the goal is that you read a page a day for 150 days. 6 months, you're living in a different way, or you have a different perception of how you live your life. It talks about the types of words that you use. The words you use influence the way you live your life. And the questions that you ask and how important those are. So it incorporates so many different lessons. And we tried to really give a taste of most of the major lessons you'll get in any personal development seminar, all packaged into a really unique and crazy book that allows teens to take it in a different way than if they were reading a lengthy book called 7 Habits of Highly Effective People or something like that.
Right. How do you decide what to write about next? And I'm particularly interested in the incredibly broad spectrum of things you've written about. You've written about philanthropy. You've written about sales. You've written about persistence, customer loyalty. You just did a book earlier this year on innovative women and top female entrepreneurs. Such a broad spectrum there, Justin. How do you decide what's next?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because for me, it's the reason I said I like the first book best is because that was what I really wanted to write about. The rest of the books that I've written really have been finding a hole in the marketplace, finding somewhere where people really need a certain message. Women need to hear about the powerful business leaders that women in today's business climate are and can continue to be. And it's really meant to be an inspiration for them to then go and start their own businesses or enter into a further leadership role within their corporation or what have you. And so that was the message that was a fit for that time. And I think all of the books I wrote after Your Mailbox is Full really were looking for, what's a message that needs to be sent today? And then writing the book that provides that message. So, at first it was really writing the book for, I wrote Your Mailbox is Full really for what I wanted to share. And then the rest of the books I've written is what they needed to hear, so much so than what I necessarily wanted to write about.
All right, then why in the world are you qualified to write about female entrepreneurs? It seems to me that, and I'll give you the fact that you did have a female co-author, Emily Espy. But still, that's a little bit sexist. Here I am as a man. I'm going to tell females how to be entrepreneurial. Some feminists may not like that.
Well, the premise of the book is not so much that I tell you what to do. The premise of that book specifically is here's a whole bunch of extraordinary women who have done it. And then let me tell you their story. Let me tell you how they've done it. I'm not going to give you the secrets. I'm not going to give you the tools. I don't know them as a, I'm a male. I'm an author. I don't necessarily know how you as a woman should become an entrepreneur or a small business executive or a thought leader or a leader in your corporation. But I can tell you the stories of those that do. And if you can hear those stories in a way that matches your experience, that matches where you're coming from today, then you're going to have a different perspective walking away from that.
Well, that makes sense. I like that. And who are the females that you cover in the book?
Gosh, we cover so many different females, from, you know, leadership executives in major corporations to PR, you know, individual small business PR firm, you know, people who have founded small businesses, people who have founded medium-sized businesses, and people who are emerging in a large-scale corporation. You know, there's so many different ways for females in business take on a higher level, a higher role, and there's a lot of room for females to emerge in that way. I mean, I think there's a lot of opportunity for women in the marketplace today. You know, and certainly we're seeing that across all different elements and all different industries and business.
All right. Now, in your role as the founder of Motivational Press, I am obsessed with the listeners publishing a book, getting out there and becoming a thought leader and the entire shtick, right? We've all heard this 1,000 times. As the guy making the decision, or someone responsible for the people making the decision, Justin, tell me about the perfect author, new author that comes to you and says, I want to write a book. Tell me the dream scenario. What does that author say? What have they done in preparation? Give me the dream package.
Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are absolutely the dream clients in the marketplace right now. You know, we just heard that Donald Trump released a new book as part of his campaign. And so, you know, certainly the more media exposure we can get, the more attention we can get to any title is the dream client. So what does that look like for the normal author? I think the simple answer is the more platform in today's marketplace, the better off you're going to be. So you want to be building your social media community. You want to be speaking at your local communities, at networking functions, at meetup groups, and start building that platform. Really get out there. The more people you're exposed to on a consistent basis, the better off you're going to be, and the more attractive you're going to be to a publisher.
Do you ever look at clout score or anything like that? You mentioned social media. Do you, are you more excited if someone's got 100,000 Twitter followers or a huge Instagram? How far do you take that?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, those numbers certainly matter as far as social media goes. And if you had no social media following whatsoever, but you were speaking in your local community, you know, 1 to 2 times a week, which would I prefer? I'd probably prefer the person speaking 1 to 2 times a week. But then there's the other side of, you know, are you in the media? Are you being interviewed in your local newspaper or in national media or what have you? I mean, we look very much at the holistic package, very much at who you are as a whole, as a thought leader on a large scale, much more so than do we look necessarily at your individual your individual social media profile or any one thing. No one thing is going to make or break you.
And then how important is the title, the thesis, the topic, all of that kind of stuff? You didn't even mention that, Justin.
Is it important? Yes. Is it going to make or break you? Not necessarily. And the reason I say that is simply because for authors today, the publisher is going to help you craft the best title. The publisher is going to help you create the marketing plan. The publisher is going to help you to create the table of contents that sells the book the best. And so is your content important? Yes, it has to be. I mean, it's either a hit or miss. It's not necessarily this gets an 8 out of 10. Or, you know, it's either this is good content or this is not good content. And then the next question is, how do we package it effectively to make that really work and to make that really sell?
Okay. And this is a stupid question. I've got to admit that, but I need to ask it. Motivational Press, are you mostly interested in motivational books, or have you grown way past that now?
Yeah, we have grown past it. We do all kinds of nonfiction work. I don't do vampires. I don't do fantasy novels, but I do anything nonfiction. And the basis for our decisions is this going to help people in their lives today? Is this going to help them, you know, take their lives to whatever's next for them? And if the answer is yes, then we're there 100% every time.
What kind of parents did you have? The reason I ask this is I have a friend whose father was a motivational speaker in the 80s, and he grew up where the father said, I don't care what your grades are. Hell, I don't even care if you go to school, but I want you to read this book by Brian Tracy or, you know, some of the incredible speakers from the 20s and 30s, Og, you know, people like that. Og Mandino. What kind of parents did you have? And now that you're getting married, and I'm sure your wife is pestering you to get her pregnant within the next 5 years, because that's the way they are. What kind of parent do you want to be, Justin? Are you going to care about grades? Because I bet you that you've now learned that grades have nothing to do with long-term success.
Well, I'll tell you, my dad's a doctor, so you know he went the traditional education route. And so he very much cares about the education. And I think for me, becoming a parent myself, I think I absolutely think that how a student does, how a child does in elementary school and middle school, it shapes them in a certain way. And it can't be the only thing. To build a well-rounded individual in today's society, you can't just expect that the school systems are going to do it, because I can tell you they're not. But ultimately, it's good groundwork, and I think it's important to start there. And of course, you know, I think my kids are going to have to do exceptionally well in school, but they're also going to have to, you know, focus a lot more attention on learning a foreign language than the schools require. They're going to have to focus on, some of those critical extracurricular activities that, you know, if you read Inc. magazine or you read Fast Company or any of the magazines, they've been talking a lot lately about some of the most important things to exercise your brain and get you to be a creative thinker. And what they talk about is learning a foreign language, learning to play a musical instrument, and doing the brain teasers that you see on all these iPhone and Android apps. You know, they say if you exercise your brain in a different way, you're going to be able to think more critically. Our schools teach you to think linearly, which is critically important. You need to be able to think. But you need to be able to think creatively just as much as you need to be able to think linearly. And that's not something our schools teach.
Did you go to college, Justin?
For about 2 weeks.
And how did your father respond when you told him that you weren't going to do that anymore?
Well, you know, it's funny. He says, you're going to be a college dropout. I said, no, I just left, because to be a dropout, you actually have to sign papers. But I literally got on a plane and went home. So it's kind of a different story for me. But ultimately, I think I was taking marketing classes where they were talking about buying and selling radio and television and print media ads. And I was saying, well, let's see here. We're in the age of social media, you know, and anyone who's buying ads on radio instead of buying Facebook ads is way behind in their marketing and advertising initiatives. And so for me, it was like, you're not even talking about the things that are really mattering in today's market. So why am I here? I can go learn it by doing it much more effectively than will I ever sitting in this classroom hearing you talk about something that's age-old wisdom in marketing.
It must be hard having the background that you did listening to a 50-year-old professor talking about something that's 100 years old.
Oh, it certainly did. You know, they say those who can't do teach.
And those who can't teach administrate teachers. So let me just finish that. And university professor for 9 years, Justin. So I am very familiar with this.
Yeah. No, I think the best teachers are those that are still doing it, you know, because even in this industry, you find there are people that they did it 10 years ago when they were starting their business, but now they have a whole team around them. They don't do it themselves. And when you start listening to them talk about some of the strategies, actually having done it myself now in my business and you know, other business owners have done the same, find that they're 5 years old in their marketing and in their wisdom and in their strategies, and they're trying to teach people how to do this. Well, I'm sorry, but what's working today isn't what worked 5 years ago.
Do you have any desire, and I do not mean this in any sort of a negative way or pejoratively or anything like that, but do you have any desire to build a business in trucking or restaurants or, not related to media and self-improvement or anything like that. But if someone came to you with a really interesting investment and said, but Justin, we want you to run the thing and we want to start a paving company, and it's going to innovate paving more than anything that happened in the paving industry in the last 200 years. Would you have, or we want you to run an energy company or a healthcare company. Do you have any interest in doing that? Or are you on your path?
No, I think it depends on the company. I mean, I certainly would be interested in taking a larger role in a more, you know, in a large scale corporation. I think it would allow me a lot more opportunity to impact. But I will say that there's two requirements for me. First is that we have to be influencing and serving the audience at a high level. I don't think, you know, a paving company is not right for me, but as a healthcare company, if I can make a difference, absolutely. But with that being said, what I know about today's market is you have to be able to change fast. You know, no matter how big of a company you are, you have to be able to move at a quick pace. The only thing that's kept us alive as a publishing house against the top publishing houses in the world is our ability to innovate and change our strategies very quickly when the big publishers take 5 years to change their strategies. And so, you know, what I know is that if I was ever to lead a major corporation, which, you know, I've been offered a couple, and I certainly would consider, you know, a major corporation if it came, you have to be able to innovate, you have to be able to move quickly, and you have to be able to change with the times. And a lot of times, companies on a large level are struggling to innovate. You know, one of our authors talks about what it took to create the mission to the moon. He was, actively engaged with NASA and helping them to create those different components. And what he talks about is our corporations are not prepared to be able to innovate at the level that they need to. And most of them are focusing on management rather than innovation. And if they focused on innovation, their revenues would skyrocket.
I published a book about 4 years ago with McGraw-Hill, and it took them over a year to get it out. And one of my big frustrations, especially as I look at publishing something next, you know, I don't want to write a book on social media and then have some publisher take a year to get it out. That's going to kill the book, right?
Right.
What do you think that motivational press does differently that makes it better than a old-timey publishing house?
Well, first of all, we move very quickly. Our books are released within 3 to 6 months. And that is usually the time it takes to build up the marketing momentum. But what really makes us different is the top 5, top 10 publishers in today's market, they're looking for authors that have a huge platform today. We help our authors build that platform. We don't expect that you're going to come to us being Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. Trust me, if you do, I'm not going to say no. But but we don't expect that that's going to happen. And so the authors that we work with are emerging. They're on their way to becoming established, and we help them through that process. We help them identify what the next path forward is and what makes the most sense for them. Those are not easy things to work through, especially in today's times.
Oh, very well said. 3 to 6 months, that's very impressive for a big house like what you have, so I'm very impressed. And Justin, I just love everything about you, your attitude, your ability to give back to others, your insistence on making a difference. And again, congratulations on the marriage. It will be the most enjoyable thing you ever do in your life, I am sure. How can people find you on social media, follow you, learn more from you? Oh, I forgot to mention the magazine that just came out, the Motivational Press magazine. How can we get involved in all things Justin Sachs?
You can find me on Facebook, of course. You can also find us at motivationalpress.com. And of course, we're always looking for new authors. And that's our core focus.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much, Justin. I hope you have a wonderful honeymoon. And I hope you never think of me on your honeymoon.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
We are out of time. Have a great day, everyone. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. Bye now.